Okay, good afternoon, everyone. My name's Luke Kasser. I'm chairing the session, this concurrent session. Dmitry Simonovich is here to talk about blockchain, smart contract, and potential insurance applications. So if you recall, when Lee asked how many people knew what a blockchain was, I think there were two people in the room, and now hopefully there should be about 50. So just a bit about Dmitry. Dmitry is a technical director of analytics at IAG. He has a particular interest in the advancement of practical actuarial methodology and its realignment with modern advances in optimization and machine learning. His other interests are in market design and risk theory. Dmitry has a PhD in computer science. I'll hand over to Dmitry.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, all right, so I'll... All right. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, thanks everyone for coming. Yeah. It's. I was hoping for a smaller session. I was actually wanted to write something on a whiteboard, but we don't have one. So that's all right. So what I'm talking about today is blockchain, what it actually is. You know, some of the existing applications that people are working on that are, I believe, are particularly well suited to the technology and that are also relevant to insurance, and as well as some sort of speculative insurance use cases that one could try and that would probably work. So if you kind of been paying attention to the white papers that come out and press releases from various parties I won't name, there is a lot of kind of excitement and noise around blockchain, right? If you go and type blockchain in insurance into Google, you'll get, you know, a dozen white papers from the usual suspects talking about, I think these are literal quotes, I don't know what it, and it's, if you read the papers, it's, and if you are somewhat skeptical, you wouldn't really know what they mean. So in my presentation here today, I'm kind of trying to demystify what blockchain really is, and to hopefully you'll get a sense of, you know, what technology can really achieve, right? And you'll be able to examine the claims out there perhaps a bit more realistically. And the one of the reasons for sort of this exuberance or hype around blockchain and sort of lack of clarity is that there's no really a single, blockchain isn't really a single concept, right? Bitcoin, you know, it came out about what now, 8-7 years ago. It's really a combination of, you know, several ideas all building on top of each other, right? However, those ideas have independent value. One is basically practical applications of public key cryptography to financial transactions. Another one is the distributed consensus algorithm that Bitcoin uses that, again, was quite novel at the time and, of course, went against kind of quite a lot of thinking in the area. And another one is smart contracts, the idea that you could have, well, essentially financial contracts that are somehow automatically settled based when executing some code and querying external conditions. So I'll basically, what I'm going to do is look through like the three or so foundational ideas that kind of underline Bitcoin and the basic blockchain technology. And then we'll see how all of those pieces come together to give and give rise to the public blockchain. So one operation or primitive that we need to understand how, well, Bitcoin and blockchain works is a so-called cryptographic hash functions. And all it is, think about it as a piece of software, right, or a bit of code, like a function in your favorite programming language, like in Excel even, that takes in an arbitrary string and returns a fixed length number, right? Very simple. So, however, to be a cryptographic hash function, they need to satisfy a couple of other properties. One is so-called collision resistance, is that if you have one string, one bit of text, and you evaluate the hash value for that string by calling that function with that text, it will be very, very hard to find another string that will give you the same value. So in fact, there should be no better way to do it than just by enumerating through all the possible strings, and it'll take you forever, depending on the size of the output of your hash function there. So an example of a function that is not a cryptographic hash function is where you just take last 16 bytes of the string, right? And it's very easy to find another string where the last 16 bytes are the same as the one you've given, so that's no good. Another one is hiding properties. So the idea there is that given the output of the hash function, you can't actually easily figure out what went in. There is no way to reverse the computation. It's a slightly more technical condition around it to actually make it work, but wouldn't worry about that. So these are hash functions, very simple idea. How can you use them? Well, one use is that you can create digests of arbitrary data. If you want to protect certain file against tampering, you just compute the hash value of that file and you store it somewhere reliably. And then if somebody goes and makes the change into the file, you'll be able to detect the change merely by recomputing the hash. This works, for example, if the file is very large and you can't store it or, and so on, whereas the hash function can be quite short. You can print it out on a piece of paper. Now, if you do this and you chain several blocks of data with hash functions kind of together, where next block of data contains a hash of the previous block of data, this gives you an idea to create a sort of linked list where you can append new blocks of data at the beginning. However, you cannot modify any of the history because then the hashes won't match. Anyway, and that's what actually a blockchain is. Now, it'd be good to draw a diagram, but anyway, can't do it. But anyway, so the idea is, it's kind of like the same as taking digest with a single file, but it allows you to grow the file as well by appending new blocks. Each block contains the hash of the previous block. This is what the technical blockchain, it's just a data structure that does that, nothing more, but it's acquired a different meaning in popular usage. So Bitcoin uses blockchain to store the transaction history. So if you think about a transaction, like let's say who made what payments, right? The transactions gets grouped into blocks, and then blocks have the hashes of the previous block. So looking at the most recent hash, only the complete history will actually match that hash. You can go back and try to match it. So that's kind of cool. So it gives you a people call it, I guess, tamper-resistant ledger. If you're in a distributed environment, you can use that to make sure people don't change things without everybody discovering it. So that was cryptographic hash functions. Now, the second part of blockchain as so-called digital signatures. Again, this idea isn't new. Like public key cryptography has been around for getting on to 40 years, but still, it's very, very powerful. The idea there is that if you want to, works very, very similar to a regular signature. If you want a digital message and you want to be able to kind of confirm or validate that it's actually you who have written it without doubt, what you do is you create a pair of keys, a secret key and a public key, S and P, so you just use software like GPG to create the pair. they have to satisfy a certain relation, but I'm not going to discuss it here. And then there are two operations. One is where you use your secret key to sign a message. This returns, again, a long integer, perhaps a few dozen bytes, perhaps. So that's one. That's to create the signature. And another one is to validate the signature. Now, as you can see, validate takes your public key, the message, and the signature, and returns true only if signature matches the message and the public key. So the owner of the secret key can sign messages, but anybody can check that those messages came from that secret key owner because they have made the public key known, and people can go and see that, you know, this public key belongs to this entity, this message is signed with the secret key corresponding to this public key, and then they know that the message did definitely originate with that entity. So that's cool. And so this is the condition that must be satisfied by this digital signature scheme, is that, you know, if you validate with the public key a message signed with the secret key, that's always evaluates to true. And of course, it also should not be possible to forge these signatures. So if you've observed somebody's signed a bunch of somebody's signed messages, you know their public key, you still, you know, you can't go and just start signing messages for them. Again, this is all pretty well understood. There's a whole bunch of schemes that have these properties out there. Now, where it gets interesting is that we can actually use public keys to identify people kind of like online in sort of it's not fully anonymous, but kind of anonymous way, right? There is no central entity issuing these public and secret key pairs. Anybody can go and generate one. However, you know, if we know that the person speaking for a particular public key actually controls the secret key. And in Bitcoin, the public keys are actually used as account numbers, or they're called addresses. So all the payments are to public keys, right? And then to redeem the payment and transfer it to somebody else, you have to control the secret key associated with the public key. It's kind of cool. I mean, you don't need, what's interesting about it is that to create a new account, again, you don't need to ask anybody. You just go and generate the pair and you get somebody to transfer your money and off you go. I mean, of course, the difficulty with this is if you have some money at a particular public key address and then you lose the secret key, it's completely irretrievable. It's gone forever. So, and of course, if somebody gets control of your secret key and so on. So it has somewhat different properties from what you might have come to expect from normal banking. So now we've got cryptographic hash functions and digital signatures. Now we can actually describe a fully functional cryptocurrency scheme. All you need are basically a way to record and validate two types of transactions. One transaction creates new money by fiat out of nowhere, instead of money, I'll call them coins here. That's what people call them. Yeah, because, well, in order to trade coins, they have to come from somewhere originally, right? So there has to be a way to create coins to get started. Another transaction is to pay coins from one public key to the other. Once you're able to do that, you have essentially a functional payment system. I'm not describing Bitcoin or similar protocol. I'm actually describing a centralized protocol, which is much simpler. We have the operator of this system, and that operator is the only person authorized to create new coins. All they need to do to create a new coin is just to sign a coin creation transaction with their secret key. And the coin creation transaction just merely has a coin ID, the public key to which the coin is assigned, and the value of the coin. And as long as we have these three, you know, data fields filled out and signed with the secret key of the scheme operator, everybody participating in the scheme agrees to pretend that this is whatever it is, it's legal tender. They'll accept this for payment. So things can obviously go wrong, but there has to be some restraint in creation of these coins, obviously. So now, when it comes to payments, all you need to do is anybody who has at least a coin assigned to one of the public keys that they control can transfer the value that coin to another public key, and the transaction needs to be signed by the owner of the coin, so with the secret key associated with the public key to which the coin was originally assigned. And in this transaction, this original coin is deleted, becomes invalid, and a new coin ID is created. Now, so the difference between the coin creation transaction is that, you know, it doesn't balance the dot, it has positive value, whereas this payment transactions always balance the value of the coins going in, always equals to the value of the coins going out. Basically the scheme operator has some rules for what constitutes a valid transaction, and it just ignores if somebody submits an invalid transaction that doesn't meet these requirements, you know, the coins being spent are active, the transaction value of the coins going in equals value of the coins going out, and the transaction is signed by the owner of the original coin. Basically, the operator takes and appends this transaction to the ledger or to the transaction history. And then basically by reading the transaction history all the way to the beginning, we will be able to figure out how much value is assigned to every public key that appears in the ledger. This system pretty much works
if you think about it, the power of the operator is actually quite limited. If they publish the hashes of the blockchain on an ongoing basis, they are not able to go back and edit the blockchain without other people finding out about it. And they can't actually make payments for the coins, you know, where they don't know the secret key they won't be able to sign the transaction. And if they try to do like an invalid signature or whatever, anyone else who's monitoring the ledger, if they publish it, will be able to discover that it's invalid. So they have limited power. However, they still can do a bunch of things, like they can ignore payments to the certain parties, from the certain parties, kind of, and then so on. So the operator still has some power. They can just pretend. Yeah, they may never append certain transactions to the ledger in the first place. And, of course, the operator itself can be shut down and so on. So one of the kind of really exciting breakthroughs original Bitcoin paper was a decentralized version of the scheme before. Right, so it works pretty much exactly the same way, but without the central scheme operator. So how does that work? Again, this is a simplified version of Bitcoin consensus, and it has a couple of important omissions that I'll come back to later. So let's just talk about at least like version 0.1 of distributed consensus algorithm. So here, there is no longer a single party. Everybody participating in the system maintains their own version of the blockchain, of the history of transactions. When somebody wants to make a payment, they broadcast it to all the nodes in the network, to all the participants. Each participant collects all the transactions that they've received, and they pick the ones they think are legal, are valid, and they put them in a block. Well, it's just a bunch of transactions in a sequence that's a block. And at irregular intervals, a randomly chosen participant is called on to broadcast its block. And other participants accept the block only if all the transactions in the block are valid. All right, so that's fine. They demonstrate that they've accepted the block by including it in their version of the blockchain. So if you think this is kind of not obvious that it works, but if you think about it, it kind of does, because the longest, if somebody gets left out, the other version of the blockchain eventually catches up. If people try to do something illegal, their transaction will likely get rejected by the majority of honest nodes and so on. It's a little bit hard to analyze, but it kind of works, and you can feel it doesn't have any like really fatal flaws. So there's still two problems. Yeah, we don't have a way to create new coins in this one, because before we had this trusted authority who would exercise restraint in creating new money, whereas here, well, everybody obviously incentivized to have as much money as possible. And there's actually also no reliable way to get, you know, just a random node to propose the new block. So in addition to that, Bitcoin introduced another concept, which was called proof of work. And the idea there is that instead of a participant being picked at random to propose a new block, instead participants compete with one another in solving this kind of extremely silly cryptographic puzzles. Okay? Each block, for a block to be valid, its hash actually has to be below a certain threshold value, and there is a certain field in the block which you can set to an arbitrary value. So people have to search through, you know, pretty much randomly through different values until the hash falls within a range. And this ensures that if everybody has equal computing power, there's no known strategy for looking for these values efficiently, it means that people win this competition essentially at random. However, if the computational power they apply to solving this puzzle isn't equal, they win it in proportion to their total hash rate, is what people call it. So that's that. Also, like just on top of that, it is valid for Bitcoin, for the new block to contain a create coin transaction that the person creating the block can assign to an arbitrary public key. Usually it's their own. So here, in one go, we kind of solved both the selection of the random participant to propose a new node, as well as the a way to allocate, incentivize the nodes and also create new currency without breaking the system. So here, new coins are created at a rate roughly proportional to the computational power available. So that's all really cool. And another thing, and as you can see, there are actually a lot of novel ideas in Bitcoin, and it's remarkable that nobody to this date has kind of come out and claimed credit for it. So another thing is smart contracts. Actually, in Bitcoin, to get the money or to make the payment aren't made to public keys, but instead, transaction contains small programs which have inputs, and you have to supply certain values to validate the payment. And it basically opened up the system to a whole range of applications that people developed later on that you couldn't have done, you know, kind of perhaps weren't thought of in the original protocol. So each transaction actually contains executable code rather than just fields. So it makes it much, much more flexible, and people came up with uses that perhaps weren't planned for at the start. So some of the, and I think kind of a bit pressed for time there, but just quickly, so what can you do with blockchain beyond payments, right? And there's quite a few really cool things. Like one are decentralized lotteries, right? When you think about a usual lottery, you have to have, well, a trusted party, the lottery organizer who collects all the money, doesn't run away, right, with the money, and chooses somebody randomly and pays them some fraction of the money they've collected. It's very costly. It's hard to organize a new lottery. Yeah, the fees there are usually substantial. So actually, on Bitcoin, however, or blockchain systems, you can create decentralized lotteries that are, you know, quite trustworthy, right? So in the way... The way it works here, I just give a brief stylized example that's really simple, and it's not really like a proper lottery. We've got three people, right, and then there is a certain protocol that they need to follow to essentially randomly decide who gets the money. The way it works in practice, they craft a Bitcoin transaction using smart contracts, with certain preconditions. It has to satisfy certain properties. They put it on the blockchain, and then after that, to claim the money back that's been assigned to a transaction, they need to create another transaction, and the effect of that transaction will be all of the money put into the contract, transferred back to one of the three participants. I won't go through the details there. Another very, very interesting application of blockchain technology that a lot of people are working on are prediction markets. And the prediction markets is sort of a PC name put forward by economists. You know, the prediction markets are going to help us to aggregate information about anything, like elections or what have you, right? However, I mean, in reality, I think the reason a lot of people are working on prediction markets for Bitcoin is because, of course, they want to do gambling. Gambling has dubious legal status in a lot of jurisdictions, and by creating these decentralized, you know, sports betting markets, you know, a lot of people are presumably hoping to get a lot of large transaction volumes and so on. So unfortunately, that's... I think that's probably the unfortunate reality of the prediction market craze, but there are a few projects that are quite advanced. And they're not on Bitcoin blockchain, they're on some other blockchains. Well, Ethereum in particular has a couple of projects. So in a prediction market, what do you need to run a decentralized prediction market? You need a mechanism to accept funds and into escrow and to make payouts. This is kind of corresponds to a combination of payment processing and capital measurement or treasury in the insurance context. You need an arbitration process for deciding the outcome of a particular event. People are betting on the outcomes. And that can be done. There's a number of designs been proposed, can be done by the consensus of the market participants, can be done by other people on the network, like the people, you know, adding new blocks, they could do it, or it can be a trusted third party. In fact, any data provider out there, right, like Bloomberg or who have you, if they were to have for the data feeds that they have, if they were to sign them with some kind of secret key and basically make those signatures available, any of the data can be used to activate the arbitration in this sort of markets. And of course, in insurance, this corresponds to essentially claims assessment process. And finally, you need something like an order book. I won't explain what it is, but it's basically like a double auction. That's how like stock markets work, to match bid and ask orders, so to match buyers and sellers. And again, it's also, there's also quite a lot of research on implementing decentralized order books. But once you've got those kind of three things together, you can have a decentralized prediction market. So just to give you a quick illustration of a very, very simple betting scheme on Bitcoin. Okay, so we have an arbitrator trusted by both A and B, so the two people betting on the market, they want to place a bet against each other. Arbitrator creates two pairs of keys, two pairs of secret and private keys, one for a no outcome and another one for a yes outcome. They publish the public keys for both, and once the event has occurred, they publish the secret key corresponding to that outcome. Okay, whether it was a yes, they publish the yes secret key. If it was a no, they publish a no secret key. Now, the two, the people betting, they wish to do the, they deposit money again to a smart contract, to a Bitcoin script, and that contract has the condition that to claim the money back, it has to have two signatures, either a signature from A and a yes, or from B and a no, right? And as soon as the event occurs, arbitrator reveals the secret key. So if it's a secret key for a no, then B can claim the money. And if it's a secret key for yes, then A can claim the money. So that's very simple, can be done, but more complicated markets that will actually work are quite a bit harder to implement. But a lot of work going on in that space. So what would be some of the, I guess, plausible insurance use cases of blockchain technology? Well, one thing you could easily do are basically digital certificates of insurance. You just have an arbitrary string describing the insurance contract, and the insurer signs it. That can be, and then anybody can kind of validate that using their public key. This can be used for, you know, when a broker sells a contract, you can actually have them provide the signature, the signed certificate of insurance to prove they actually notified the insurer. You can do, if it's some kind of statutory thing, you can also use this as a proof. Now, it doesn't work if the certificate is revoked, but oh well. Another one is you can do insurance pools. When you think about a decentralized lottery, just a very simple decentralized insurance pool or a saving club are very, very similar to a lottery. So it's just the conditions of kind of how the beneficiaries are determined are slightly different, but that can be well accommodated. Insurance markets, again, there is no fundamental difference between a prediction market and an insurance market. Insurance market has like constraints on, for example, you may want to ensure that people have insurable interest in certain outcomes. Usually insurance events people want to insure against are not really a matter of public interest, so it will be hard to kind of rely on the consensus for arbitration. You'll need perhaps a third parties who are properly compensated. But when you look at the insurance linked securities with parametric triggers, they're already very, very similar to prediction markets and can be implemented. Some similar contracts can be implemented with those mechanisms. And another thing is you can, when you're building your core systems, instead of having, you know, sort of monolithic systems with hard-coded business logic, you could move logic into smart contracts and just have a system that kind of supports execution of smart contracts. So there's just some ideas that seem to be reasonably well aligned with what people are doing in that space today, kind of outside insurance. At the answer, some points. Yes. Yeah, so actually, a lot of those things we've talked, insurance use cases, don't require like the full public blockchain. Those three ideas that build on one another, they just require certain bits of it, like kind of the similar kind of bits we use to build up the main idea. Early successes in insurance will likely use or reuse the work that people are doing in those other areas. In particular, the areas where blockchain will likely to be more successful in insurance is where low friction automated outcome arbitration is available. So you have ideally signed data feeds coming from somewhere. Like one example that sounded really good was flight delay insurance, where you can use information provided by essentially airports to decide on settlements. That was a really, really good example. Another good example would be lost devices. So when a device is placed, let's say, by Apple into lost mode, that can act as a trigger for payment as well. It won't be like, as you can see, this stuff really, really doesn't fit for your traditional motor or home insurance. So those are very unlikely to be the first thing off the rank. If you think about the public blockchain in general, I mean, look, guys, it's just the stuff's just completely out there, right? I think when people talk about like revolution and disruption, it is true, but it won't take the form that we can't really imagine what it'll look like today. So yeah, certainly, I can't anyways. So that's all from me. Thank you.
If you had any questions, could I please ask you to use the microphone in the aisle? Okay, I'll ask a question. Dimitri, with new kind of, like to me this looks like a new database kind of structure. Does this kind of bring about any new kind of cybersecurity issues? There was a report, I think, a few months ago of a kind of public venture capital service that actually got hacked and people lost, I think, a third of the value of the bitcoins in there.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, look, with this technology, right, the security considerations are completely different from what you would have with kind of the financial instruments we are used to. Because, I mean, again, aside the example that you've mentioned, that one was really, really complicated, and it's perhaps not surprising that that happened. But even if you lose your secret key for your Bitcoin account, that's it, the money is irretrievably lost. There is nobody you can appeal to at all, right? So there is, you have to be very careful and treat those things in a very sort of different way to how you might otherwise. Essentially, with all this automated settlement, there is no recourse unless the recourse was built in advance and anticipated.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Just wanted to know if there was anyone in any businesses in Australia using blockchain or looking to use blockchain at the moment.
If you look at press releases, I mean, there is a fair bit of activity, I think. So there were quite a few things in the news from Commonwealth Bank recently, for example. So, I mean, again, all of those things are, you can't say they're used as such. They're more of like this kind of innovation, corporate innovation initiatives. Usually the press releases don't contain enough detail to sort of critically assess them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if there are no more questions, could I please get you to thank Dimitri again?